You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. On the program today, Ann Newman, the author of The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America, contributing nonfiction editor at Guernica, writing in The Baffler, Who Owns Vaccines? How Nationalist IP Hoarding Will Prolong the Pandemic. Meanwhile, India breaks a record one day of COVID cases. The vaccination rate in the U.S. slows as we bump up against the conservative deniers. Meanwhile, speaking of conservative deniers, Republicans throw back Thursday. They're looking to stage another debt ceiling fight. Meanwhile, Joe Biden to recognize the Armenian genocide. New report, Donald Trump surpassed the IG report that showed his administration was blocking Puerto Rican aid. A breaking story, the Postal Service police have apparently been running a covert program to monitor social media. Senate confirms Vinita Gupta. And on Earth Day, Joe Biden convenes a climate summit. Spoiler alert, we need to do more and faster. The Manhattan DA will no longer prosecute prostitution, which of course is no substitute for legalization. And lastly, Idaho is primed to pass a fetal heartbeat law. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it. Joining me, as always, is Emma Viglin. Emma, how are you?
I am well. How are you? Happy Throwback Thursday, as you put it.
That's right. It's Throwback Thursday. That's the first time I think I've ever said those words, actually. But the idea to wake up to the idea that Republicans are now going to rediscover the debt ceiling
after increasing the debt by $7 trillion under Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even the size of the debt. I want to remind people what this means with the debt ceiling. The money's already been spent. The money has already been spent on all. Whenever we get to the debt ceiling, the question isn't whether we're going to spend more money. The question is whether we're going to pay the bill that we have already expended. It is really like saying, you know what? I've really got to curb my credit card spending when the bill comes and you say, I'm not going to pay it. Now, with all that said, there is no reason for us not to continue to deficit spend and to in this particular environment that we're in. This particular performative action by the Republicans, and everybody has done it over the years. You know, there one or two lawmakers will vote against the raising of the debt ceiling as a way of establishing, as making some type of political point. We're going to get a good apples-to-apples comparison as to how the Biden administration will handle this versus the Obama administration did. So that could very well be interesting, but we will stay on top of that. First, I want to play a clip. I interviewed Alex Zajac the other day for the second exclusive hour we do on Peacock about his piece, How Bill Gates Impeded Global Access to COVID Vaccines. And we're going to be talking to Ann Newman, who's going to give us sort of a broader sense of this question. But we're starting to see the implications in various places around the world of the failure of the West, essentially, to make vaccinations and vaccines available to be produced in other countries. India right now is going through a devastating surge of COVID infections. And here is a report from Democracy Now.
Well, we should just quickly say they broke the single-day COVID case rise record.
Indeed.
Previously held by the U.S., so it's over 314,000 cases.
Yes, and this is accelerating. Here is a report from Democracy Now. Raina Ayyub is outlining just how dire it's becoming in India.
It is an apocalyptic situation in India right now. It's heartbreaking not just to be a citizen of this country, but it's heartbreaking to be a journalist who is bearing witness to the events that are unfolding in India, especially with the number of COVID deaths that we are witnessing, and many of them in their early 30s. The two friends that I lost were in their mid-30s. Their families are still in the ICU. Yesterday, 22 patients lost their lives at one go in a hospital after a tank that was providing oxygen to the ventilators leaked for 30 minutes, and all 22 patients lost their lives in a span of an hour. And there is, I mean, it's like this country is breathless. On Twitter, in hospitals, whenever I'm going to report, everybody is begging for oxygen. As I'm talking, hospitals after hospitals in the national capital, not far from the Prime Minister's residence, are petitioning the High Court of the country to tell them that we have no oxygen left in our hospitals. State governments are accusing each other of oxygen theft, that they are stealing each other's oxygen tankers. It's that kind of a situation. An investigation done by news website Scroll day before suggested that the government of India had invested billions of rupees from the Prime Minister of the PM CARES Fund for setting up 162 oxygen plants. And so far, only 33 such plants have been functional in India. So clearly, we have not learned our lessons from the pandemic last year when a lockdown was announced and there was a migrant exodus. The situation in India right now is apocalyptic because the visuals are searing. I just wrote about the story of this young woman who was in her mid-30s, who had been wanting to have a child for 17 years. She gave birth to twin daughters. And within hours, she died because she was COVID positive and there was no oxygen in the hospital. So that's the level of devastation that we are seeing. Patients, families are carrying their patients on hand carts and stretchers and carrying oxygen cylinders and begging for them on social media. And we're still talking about the privileged section, Amy. We're not even talking about rural India, from which there is so much underreporting. And we don't know how many deaths are being reported in rural India.
That's a harrowing story.
Horrible.
And account.
Horrible. And, you know, the opportunity for these type of situations to exist throughout other parts in the world are there in large part because we as a world are not doing enough to make sure that we get vaccines out the door, or at the very least that these countries are put in a position to produce low-cost vaccinations. I mean, it really is stunning. We're going to talk more.
Well, at the very least, we're not releasing some of the stockpile, but what should be done is a patent waiver.
Well, and that's what we're going to be talking to Ann Newman about.
Exactly.
We don't have nearly enough vaccinations to make the dent, but we could easily, with one essentially decision, make it possible for the world to produce enough of those vaccinations. And we will talk to Ann Newman about that in a moment. First, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this. Folks, this episode is brought to you by CuriosityStream. It is a subscription streaming service, but it's different from all those others. It's basically like I guess Netflix for nerds, or you know, like it's sort of like what Well, part of it is sort of like what the History Channel used to be, frankly. You know, now it's just like a bunch of reality shows and, you know, Save My Pawn Shop or whatever it is.
And, yeah, alien shows that aren't history related and, in fact, quite dubious.
Aren't even, like, necessarily reality related. Anyways, Curiosity Stream, like I say, it's like a Netflix for nerds. It is, you get unlimited access to all sorts of documentaries and sort of docu-style programming that is really fascinating. It starts at just $2.99 a month. You can get it for $20, well, $19.99 a year. And for our audience, the first 30 days are completely free if you sign up at curiositystream.com/majority report. Use the promo code majority report, all one word, lowercase, no quotes, just majority report, during the sign up process.
This all looks incredible.
It's amazing. And I, the other night I watched, Richard Attenborough. Do you know who that guy is? He's sort of like the British,
isn't it David Attenborough?
David Attenborough. And he's got there's a whole bunch of them that he's done on there, but the one that I got caught up in was Ant Mountain. And he traveled to some place to the Swiss Alps, and there is a mountain where there is like all these ant colonies that are, you know, like sizable little hills, and then the ants are incredibly territorial. So not only do you see how they you know, some of them, they'll be like mixed families of ants, billions of ants. And then there's others where it's like just one sort of genetic strain of ants, and they go about 10, 12 feet and they bump up against another, and then they have these wars. It's nuts. But they've got all sorts of type of documentaries. I got one queued up on Stalin's James Bond, who was a real sort of like a James Bond type figure for the Soviet Union. He was a master spy in Japan. He's sort of widely considered to be like the model for James Bond. So there's a whole sort of range of different things. Also great stuff for like kids, specifically for kids, and then stuff like, you know, like Saul. I'm going to watch the ant thing again with Saul because he's going to love it.
There's one called The Neanderthal's Dark Secrets, so Sam Harris might be interested in that.
That's true. There's nature, there's history, there's technology, there's society, there's lifestyle. They're adding new titles all the time at Curiosity Stream. It is also available on all the platforms, web app. You can do it on Roku or Android or Xbox One. Smart TVs, iOS, Chromecast, you know, Amazon Fire and Kindle, Apple TV. You can get it anywhere. Like I say, $19.99 a year, $2.99 or $2.99 a month. You can check it out. Go to curiositystream.com/majority report for unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series. Like I say, for only $2.99 a month or just $19.99 for the whole year. And for Majority Report fans, use promo code Majority Report. You will get your first 30 days of Curiosity Stream completely free. Check it out. We will put a link in the YouTube and podcast.
And it's available on Roku. I'm going to get it tonight.
Yeah, that's what it says. All of them.
Amazon, Fire, and Kindle.
They put them out everywhere. Hmm. All right. Now I'd like to welcome to the program Anne Newman. She is the author of The Good Death and Exploration of Dying in America. She's a contributing nonfiction editor to Guernica. And she's writing in The Baffler, Who Owns Vaccines? How Nationalist IP Hoarding Will Prolong the Pandemic. Anne, thanks for joining us. Okay, so I think joining us, excuse us for that little brief technical situation. Anne Newman is with us. Anne, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. So, Anne, I was just reading a new poll that finds 60% of the voters want Joe Biden to endorse a motion by more than 100 lower and middle income countries to remove patent barriers on COVID-19 vaccines at the World Trade Organization. Only 28% of Americans disagreed. So this is, you know, about as popular as about anything in the country could be. Give us a sense of just like, you know, what the worldwide situation is when it comes to vaccines.
Yeah. Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me. The vaccine industry is not really popular with big pharma because they don't make a lot of money from it up until these days, right? The pandemic has changed that business model significantly because of all the government money. But up until now, vaccines have been lower cost in the United States. They're covered by the Affordable Care Act. And as we know, that's kind of a precarious model. In some cases, the current vaccine is being charged to insurance companies. But around the world, the global drug supply, the supply chain basically runs through India by way of China. And so that's a rather precarious situation when we are reliant on a few countries. I think, in fact, something like 70 or 80% of our drugs in total are made by India. And 70% of those APIs or active pharmaceutical ingredients are coming from China. So if there's any disruption, like that opening clip that I think you just watched about how the pandemic is ravaging Gujarat and other parts of India, that indeed is a problem for all of us because it could possibly affect the global supply chain of drugs.
What is and so you know we have this motion by more than 100 lower and middle income countries because clearly they can't afford it. I mean just elaborate on that concept because I'm not sure that people in the United States get the concept of like the country just can't afford to produce these vaccines as the way it is now constructed our vaccine regime.
Right. And that's because these countries have been plagued by capitalism and other sort of extractive colonial practices for a long period of time. These are economies that are not as robust as ours. And that's, of course, relative. And they're countries with populations that do not live the kind of lifestyle that we live. The global South is a very different place. And in part, that is because of the global North and our rapacious history. And so what these countries have been doing, and India in particular, after independence, the country said, we are establishing laws that favor our people over these colonial paradigms, and we want drugs to remain affordable. And in the past, companies like Novartis have gone to the Indian courts and said, we do not want any of our drugs to be generics. We don't want Indian manufacturers to reverse engineer them and make them affordable to more people. And they have continued to lose because the Indian Supreme Court has held its line. But not a lot of countries have that kind of toughness when it comes to resisting American imperialism and power. And so they're left at the moment. And I know that we can get into the current structure, but they're left at the moment to kind of beg for drugs that, indeed, when countries can't get enough vaccines, we all suffer because the longer this pandemic goes on, the more chance there are of strains developing and that virus coming back to us.
What are the countries that come to mind that are experiencing outside of, we're talking about India's COVID surge, but that are bearing the brunt of not really having, I guess, the court and infrastructure that that India does in order to push back against the power of these manufacturers?
There aren't many that can. I mean, the larger countries with bigger populations, but it's really, these companies exist in the global north. And as we've seen, they've been protected by their home countries. I mean, the entire Operation Warp Speed was kind of a raining of resources, like $10 billion down on six individual companies. The Pfizer drug that was developed with BioNTech, a German company, they received $445 million from the German government. So this is like a global north monopolization of this resource that is necessary all over the globe. And And there are a number of forces that are protecting that. One is just government power and...
Excuse me one second, Ann, before we get into the sort of the structure of that. I just want to get also a sense of, you know, let's just broaden out for one moment and just, you know, like work on the premise of like the value of the vaccine being widely distributed around the globe. I mean, let's obviously there's just sort of a humanitarian obligation, it seems, in the context of a pandemic. We certainly wouldn't stand for this if it was, you know, Alabama or New Jersey or, you know, Iowa that like they just don't have vaccines. And we're, you know, we're OK with that. We wouldn't allow for that. We also wouldn't do the same with Canada or Mexico, it seems to me. So we have a humanitarian obligation to do this. We have a sort of a self-serving one insofar as like this is a pandemic and we've seen we're not protected, you know, if this continues on. What are the other implications of this pandemic sort of ravaging in other countries?
Yeah, well, you're more optimistic about what we would or wouldn't do than I am.
Fair enough.
Yeah. At the moment, there are 130 countries that don't have a single dose. And these are large populous countries. Our obligation as human beings, and I like to do what you're doing. This is exactly what I do in the piece. I step back and say, oh, the current structure, oh, the current government. The largest issue is that millions of people are dying unnecessarily. Millions. As a country that once held a leadership position on this globe, we have lost that, not just under the last administration, but also because we have failed to address this global crisis with any kind of ethical understanding of what the value of life is. All this America First stuff, even under Biden, you know, this 200 million doses distributed in his first 100 days, that's fantastic. But there are a lot of us who could stay home. Those doses could be used by, say, Nigerian nurses who are just trying to save lives. And so this America First mentality has prevented us from being leaders, from saving millions of lives, but also from eradicating a plague that still is over our head, that still could do great damage to us. We are by far not out of the woods on this. So yes, on the soul level, we are hideous right now.
And I would say that, like, you know, if that's not enough to inspire people, and the idea that there could be variants that come back around is not enough to inspire. You know, we are in the midst. We've been in the midst really for over a decade of this sort of pivot to the Pacific, where we are, you know, theoretically building up some type of vanguard to Chinese, I guess, expansion, I don't, or influence maybe. But if we genuinely believed that China was some type of national security threat or had the potential to be one, like, what would be the value from that perspective in terms of like diplomacy and influence around the world if we either A, stop preventing people from getting vaccines, or actually facilitated these 132 countries to get some vaccines?
Oh, yeah, it would do us a huge amount of goodwill. It would be very good for the United States to do what we could to save lives in these countries where they can't access the vaccine right now. However, we kind of set up this paradigm, or at least American citizens, namely Bill Gates, was very influential in setting up this paradigm of America First, of not thinking, I mean, if diplomacy compels us, by all means, we should use it. Saving lives should be our first effort. But from the very beginning, that has not been our intention as a country.
Can you go through the specific? And so now let's look towards the actual, you know, the the investment that we made as a society in these, because the story is like, you know, that I think a lot of people feel is like, well, they did all the research and development. They hustled on this. They really risked a lot. And by they, I mean the Pfizer's, the Johnson & Johnson, the Moderna. There's a couple other companies that didn't succeed, but they didn't really risk anything, did they? We did. We invested in it. This is a classic case of like of socializing the cost and privatizing the profits, I guess. So walk us through how much the U.S. government actually gave to the development and creation of these. And if we need to even go back before it became a COVID vaccine and just the concept of mRNA.
Yeah, mRNA was developed by the National Institutes of Health for the most part. So that was all government funding. I'm not sure of the dollar amounts, but it was big money. And the NIH has been doing this kind of development for a very long time. There are two ruses that the pharmaceutical industry likes to use. One is that if we address their practices, maybe rein in their prices, it will stifle innovation, which in my mind is a ridiculous acknowledgement of the fact that they're not really here to save lives, right? That altruism stuff is out the window with that statement. And the other thing that we've seen come out now, particularly as the dollar amounts of public funds have been written about, the other thing that they're saying, and that Bill Gates really grabbed onto, was special manufacturing. Like, we cannot make our recipe for this vaccine open source because, first of all, nobody can do it the way we can do it. Special manufacturing is a patented process. And secondly, it'll stifle innovation if you interrupt our IP rights. So they have used those two arguments extensively over a long period of time, and it works. If you Google right now intellectual property innovation, you will see all sorts of people writing for the New York Times and Washington Post, mostly industry people, but still, they're very invested in this. And they've done a great job of using that in the moment to monopolize the access to public funds, but also this kind of new structure of government paying for not only the research and development, but also the distribution. And then on top of that, they're negotiating individually with countries, right? So when the Ukraine went to find vaccine doses, they were forced to sign a non-disclosure contract. So they're almost negotiating in the dark. Countries don't really know what other countries are paying. So then they can't really negotiate good prices or even affordable prices for themselves. It's a racket, really.
All right. Well, so let's be explicit, though. Like, how much money did the U.S. government pay? You mentioned that BioNTech, which is partnered with Pfizer, got $500 million approximately from the German government. How much money? But the story that we hear about Pfizer is, well, they didn't participate in Operation Warp Speed, so they didn't get any money. But that's not true.
It's not true. They got $1.95 billion, I believe. $10 billion went into Operation Warp Speed. And so they still got, you know, almost $2 billion. To buy a number of doses, right? And that payment was guaranteed whether the doses worked or not. I mean, that agreement was way before the study was even done.
So just to be clear here, I mean, this is like me saying to Emma, I want to encourage you to build a hot dog stand, and I am going to buy right now $1.5 billion worth of hot dogs. And if you can't figure out how to do the stand, don't worry. You're still going to get that money. As long as you give a good faith effort, you're going to get that $1.5 billion. I mean, so there was no risk associated with what Pfizer did here at all, that we gave them a $1.5 billion grant, and they weren't even part of the supposed program. And with Moderna, we did the same thing in terms of promising to buy, but we also invested in the hot dog bun technology, the boy that you had, right? I mean, that's basically it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from top to bottom, this was not a risk for these companies. I mean, maybe a risk in their reputation or something, but they've survived worse.
And it was not just not a risk. I mean, the fact that they were even in this race to begin with, I remember in the midst of the pandemic, stock prices soaring, and now you see reports of the billions in stock buybacks that executives are getting from AstraZeneca, J&J, and Pfizer, et cetera, that essentially could be used to, Common Dreams wrote an article about how that amount of money, $23 billion or so, could fund vaccine distribution in the entire continent of Africa. Is that the right number, Sam?
$26 billion. What were the other companies? I mean, if the idea was that there was a reputation to there, I just want to like really make it clear that they had virtually no risk associated with any of this. All of the stories that we are told as to why these companies deserve profits, or these massive profits, involve the risk that is associated with them trying to develop this thing. You mentioned risk to reputation. I don't even remember what the other companies who clearly did not come up with a vaccine, who they were. So, the risk is not terribly, it seems to me like, you know, maybe within the pharmaceutical industry, if there's another opportunity to pay off billions of dollars, but there doesn't seem to have been any risk at all associated with this.
No, and the profits are uncommon. Right. Like the vaccine industry, as I said earlier, was never something that big pharma really wanted to dabble in because, you know, they get their money from, say, a drug that you need to take every day to keep your blood pressure up or down. The special cancer drugs are what they really want. And I think there's also rumbling right now that these big pharma companies that do have successful vaccines want to raise the price once that they feel as though we're out of emergency mode. We're looking at a future where I assume you're both vaccinated, but that vaccine, according to Art Kaplan, who I spoke to for this piece, might last us a year, might. And we're looking at other strains, and we're looking at a future where this is something that we have to address with vaccines on a regular basis, regular ongoing basis. And that looks promising to these large companies that now hold the rights to these vaccines are, you know, poised to make lots more money.
Let's turn our attention to Bill Gates. on this. I mean, you touch on his involvement in this. I mentioned that I had for another in another outlet had interviewed Alex Zajac, who did a really sort of a very deep dive into Bill Gates' participation in this and his sort of really malignant, I think it's fair to say, influence on public health. It is not terribly dissimilar to his influence on education in this country. Just want to remind everybody, he spent about $1 billion through the Gates Foundation. There were other programs, $1 billion on essentially what was an experiment that took place more or less in the Pacific Northwest with a bunch of schools, maybe a dozen, half dozen schools, that money acted like a magnet. And almost like a source of gravity, and all of that, it brought all of these. It fundamentally changed our education system in this country for 20 years. And after 10 years of that, they commissioned the Rand Corporation to assess the value of their experiment. And the Rand Corporation said, "Total failure. We should have done exactly what the educator said." And that was it. It was barely reported upon. It was about 3 years ago. And it feels like this is the same situation. Will you talk about Bill Gates's involvement in COVAX and like where that came from and what they promised to do and what they've been able to achieve with it?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear the shout out to Alex. It's a great piece. And he's a buddy. So you call Bill Gates malignant. I would call him deadly at the moment. He also has a large role in the climate crisis and is influencing our approach to it. But what he did in this situation was he heard the noise from Oxford, who had a promising vaccine, that they wanted to make it open source, accessible to everyone. And he convinced them to not do so. He partnered them up basically with AstraZeneca. Alex calls him, I think, the most influential man in global public health. And that means that this influence is wielded by an individual who's been told he was a genius since, I don't know, he was working in his dad's garage or whatever, who probably has a lot of yes people around him, and who strongly believes that corporations and philanthropy can save the day. So this weakening of government, which we know always compromises equality and egalitarian policy, not that we're a model of that at the moment, but he is, because of where his wealth comes from, a real advocate for sticking by intellectual property laws and patent rights. And I think that was a real surprise to global health leaders because of the future that we were looking at more than a year ago. These leaders were saying, there's no way that we can maintain IP laws. We're going to have to go around that. And Bill Gates stepped in with his money and his panache and changed the course of history.
I mean, this is the, I mean, if folks want another example of the danger of a plutocracy, it is that for a guy, him expending several billion dollars in the context of this pandemic is functionally you losing three or four of the books on your bookshelf. And then maybe at one point you notice it, but not really. No. But based upon his belief in IP, he convinces Oxford, like you say, to not make this open source. Mm-hmm. Had a history of doing this. I think it was World War II. I can't remember what it was that they had developed something that I can't remember exactly what it was that they basically provided for the world. He also pushed the development of this COVAX, which is almost a rival initiative to one that was starting to come out of the World Health Organization. And it was his way of basically controlling the response and heading off this move to get rid of IP for these vaccinations. Tell us what COVAX's plan was and what their stated goal was and whether they've achieved it.
Oh, well, they haven't achieved it. They are behind schedule and behind budget, whether that's distribution of vaccines or gathering donations from larger countries. The objective was never thorough or advanced. It was always kind of a compromise organization. And they wanted to supply maybe 20% of the world's vaccines, and then countries were on their own. And they wanted to do that through gathering donations from richer countries, which hasn't really happened. I think the United States gave some money, but it's pretty limited. And then use that profit to subsidize vaccine doses elsewhere. So it's still a market approach. Right. It's still saying, we have a problem here, but we're going to let the market solve it. And we'll do a little charity on the side. It was never a robust solution to the problem. In other words,
and to hear Zajac write about it, it was basically just a co-optation of an effort. Yes. That was going to be far more collectivist, I guess.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, at the very beginning, we're talking the WHO and other organizations really thought that there would be a sharing of information around the globe, not just vaccine recipes, but also manufacturing techniques and the materials necessary to make the vaccines. We really thought at the beginning that this was going to be a global effort just because of the size of the crisis that we were looking at. And when that didn't come about, it was a bit of a shock to people. I think just the development of COVAX, kind of fully formed out of Bill Gates's head, was a surprise to people. And he's been very successful in rerouting all of the resources through it.
Tell us, you mentioned the Ukraine, but will you walk us through that story? Because this really It's almost an extortion on some level, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, any time in my mind that you say, we will help save your life if you give us money, there's a kind of extortion taking place. So the Ukraine, after a recent revolution, had realized that there was a large amount of graft involved in the prior administration. So the new administration and courts passed a lot of laws to prevent non-disclosure contracts with the government. And this was meant to stop corruption, which was rampant all over the Ukraine. And these were very good laws. However, when the Ukraine saw outbreaks among their population, they were hustling around to try and secure some doses. But every pharma they approached required that they sign a contract with non-disclosure riders in it, meaning they could not discuss the details of the contract, could not make them public with their population. This put them in the double bind of either breaking their own laws and getting doses of the vaccine or not getting doses of the vaccine. And it was a terrible place for the country to be in. And they did what they had to do to save the lives of their people. They got a limited number of vaccine doses. But that's what the nature of these contracts is. It is shady and extortionist. And why would you want other countries to have to negotiate blindly, to not know what rates were being received by other countries around the world? It's unconscionable. And yet it is happening everywhere.
And so is the point from the perspective of pharma to make sure that the price secured by the Ukraine, is not disclosed. Is it the idea is that, like, look, we as pharma, we can't afford from a public relations standpoint to not provide them with vaccinations whatsoever. However, we also, as a business enterprise that wants to gouge as much money as squeeze literally every single dollar we can out of people, we can maybe discount them a price, but we don't want to give a baseline for other countries to negotiate against. Is that it? I mean, it's basically like we're not going to lose money by giving them this vaccine, but we're not going to make as much as we could if we keep it a secret that we're giving them a little bit of a break for PR purposes, essentially.
Right. I think the pharma companies are doing fine on PR here in the United States. You know, everybody's talking like, oh, they saved us. Thank God for science. And so we conflate pharma corporate practices with science and we give them the good nudge. They weren't really popular with the American people up until COVID-19. I don't know that the pharma really cares how much other countries think of them, particularly countries that are in Eastern Europe or the global South. Although one would expect that they would have some sort of conscience about the fact that they are trying to get as much money as they can. So Big Pharma has conflated ethics and profit. They think that their goal is to sell vaccines and save lives. But really what they're doing is making profit. And that's not really good for their public image.
Well, yeah. And that, I mean, that's why I say public relations, because if they don't, if they don't provide this to Ukraine, this builds the support for essentially suspending their, or maybe revoking their intellectual property protections. So give us a sense of like what Joe Biden could do with, I think, essentially a stroke of the pen in terms of providing over 100 countries with at least one shot, essentially.
Yeah, he could do it with a stroke of a pen. He should have done it as soon as he came in. This should have been done more than a year ago. There are a couple of reasons why, or there are a couple examples of when that was done in the past with AIDS drugs. There was a lawsuit where an Indian company said, listen, we're going to make this generic drug accessible to the global South, and did so and won their lawsuit. And another example is a Novartis lawsuit in India that took place. And I mentioned it a little bit earlier. And the Indian courts protected the very wonderful generic laws that exist in India. So there is precedent. We do know how to do this. And the Biden administration should have done it immediately.
And well, that is to basically strip these, just to be clear for the audience, strip these manufacturers of their intellectual property patent protection.
Right. And as it would work, it would just shield the formula for these vaccines. I think it has to also include some of the manufacturing techniques. But also, I mean, these drugs aren't manufactured in the United States, you know, like Johnson & Johnson does some of their manufacturing in-house, but for the most part, you know, it's already farmed out to other places. But that knowledge has to also be shared in order for manufacturer to pick up in low to middle income countries and become accessible.
I mean, do we have a set? Well, before we get there, what would be the mechanics of this? Like, what authority would Joe Biden be able to do, would be able to sort of suspend these patents, both from a formula and from the production technique? What is the mechanics, or what is the authority?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam. I'm not sure what the legal mechanism would be.
All right. Yeah. So with that said, it's quite clear. I mean, he's debating whether or not to do it. Mm-hmm. People are calling on him. He clearly has it in some form or another. So what about the production capacity? I've read about in Bangladesh, factories saying we can do this. But do we have a sense of, like, let's say tomorrow Biden was to exercise this authority, say, you know, these formulas are now open source, and this means in which to produce this is now open source. Where would we anticipate production happening?
Oh, I would say India, again, the country that manufactures 80% of the United States drugs. But also, I mean, drugs are made all over the world in generic form and otherwise. So it's not as though these big pharmas are the only ones who can provide this vaccine or manufacture it. It's the fact that this specific recipe has been patented under intellectual property law, which we could discuss the meaning of it, the evolution of it. And that idea has been captured and held for the sake of corporate profit. That is solely it. The only thing that is impeding the manufacturer all over the world is these individual corporations holding on to their ability to make money from it.
And in fact, we're seeing that it's not necessarily the most effective method. I mean, Johnson & Johnson contaminated at least 50 million doses of their vaccine, and yet they're still trying to make the argument that they're the only ones that are have the capacity to.
Right. I mean, just that attitude that they're the only ones who could do this, that their manufacturers or their research people, their manufacturing experts are the only ones who can put out this vaccine is really it's a biased view of the world.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's demonstrably incorrect, as did today. The New York Times is writing about federal inspectors fear more vaccines, more than 15 million were exposed to contamination. Mm-hmm. At the subcontractor that Johnson & Johnson uses. Apparently, the FDA has been aware of this company's problems. The subcontracted emergent, I guess it's called, their problems in production for almost a year at this point, at least. So let's just give us a little bit of background on this so-called intellectual property. The patents really is what we're talking about. This is not patents weren't designed for this, were they?
No, and the law developed over time to give them a particular protection that we're seeing now, the bad ramifications of this kind of construing of the law. Intellectual property is a strange term, right? So patents we usually think of as protecting objects. This idea, this science for the vaccine is now being wrongly constricted. I just lost my train of thought. I think the problem with intellectual property is that it's really hard to understand the law. right? And so quite often it is a complicated issue that we don't understand, don't get into. And that acts as a screen for companies that want to use it to protect their own rights. This problem has exacerbated over the past 50 years. And Dean Baker was fantastic in explaining it to me for the Baffler piece. But what we found is that it's favored corporations over time, to the extent that we find that millions of people are dying for the sake of corporate profit. I don't know how to simplify it any more than that. Even if intellectual property rights work for, say, a novel that I've written, or a piece of music that you've written, we're in a different realm at the moment. We're talking about millions of lives. And so clearly we have to readdress the laws that that we're abiding by at the moment.
And I would also argue that on top of the fact that we are showing fealty to these sort of dubious property rights over the lives of literally hundreds of millions of people, to use the analogy of your book, I gave you an advance.
Right.
I share in those, I have some ownership of that book. You know, we may have negotiated a certain thing where you have a certain rights, but I've licensed that book already.
You got your money.
and the point is that the U.S. government paid for these things. And so we're subsidizing the development of these things. And then we subsidized the purchase and the distribution of these things all throughout. And to the extent that it was necessary, we didn't really get anything back, right? In terms of, we didn't get anything. If the paradigm of those who risk the money deserve the biggest returns, which is what we're constantly told by these same companies, well, we were the ones who risked the money. It should be our returns and our ability to sort of open source this.
Yeah, and yet I do think in the United States, like we're all in New York here, I think, we're all vaccinated. And there are people in other parts of the world that are looking at 3 years for that. So, in the United States, it's been a raw deal. But if we paid that much money and we were finding that vaccine doses were being used around the world, I could probably handle that loss of money. I could probably say, okay, let the corporations go. But the fact is that they're extorting this money from us and they're not being effective. Their plan is not working. People are going to continue dying for a long period of time. And then in the next year, we're going to need more vaccine doses.
Right. And lastly, let me just ask you this, getting back to Bill Gates a little bit. Do you have a sense of, in this community where they were, where folks expressed surprise at the approach that COVAX was taken, that there is a more jaundiced view of Bill Gates's role in this world? I mean, and by this world, I mean specifically the public health world, because I mean at one point he was considered laughable when he showed up at these forums, and then of course when you shove several billions of dollars, then all of a sudden everybody likes you because one way or another their funding is coming from you. Has there been any expression of like, oh boy, this money is coming with certain strings that I didn't quite anticipate?
I think a small community that kind of saw his workings at the very beginning might not think of him as positively as they did before. But if you ask anyone on the street right now, they think that Bill Gates is a great guy. He's very involved in, public health around mosquito nets, all of that. And I think this role that he has played in the eyes of many who don't understand exactly what he's been doing, I think to many people, they think he's a great guy for helping us get the vaccine distributed. That's the sadness of and the power of Bill Gates' PR team.
Unless you're the anti-vax crowd who thinks you're being microchipped by him. They don't think him so positively.
Right. Although we still have a lot to learn about what the size and effectiveness of that group is.
True.
Indeed. Anne Newman, author of The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America, and her piece, Who Owns Vaccines? How Nationalist IP Hoarding Will Prolong the Pandemic. We will put a link to that from the Baffler at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a... We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this. So we're back. Today is Earth Day, and as such, there's a Joe Biden is holding a climate summit where they're trying to get collective action. He made a pledge the other day to cut emissions by half until from now, between now and 2030. And we need to be doing a lot more, moving a lot quicker, as it were. We just had, and one of those things, if we're going to be doing any of this, is going to have to involve the U.S. Senate figuring out a way that it can pass legislation that the president supports and that Democrats ostensibly support. And that's going to involve getting rid of the filibuster, or at the very least, modifying it in some way. And there's really one person who has the greatest amount of responsibility for that. And that is the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. And here is an ad that Chuck Schumer has put out about how much he likes to ride his bike, and that ostensibly that means that he is going to be able to fight climate change. Here is that ad.
Saturdays, I'm in New York. I ride my bike along the Brooklyn waterfront. I'm not a spandex guy. I'm not going at 40 miles an hour. I ride slowly. I take in the beauty of Brooklyn, and I wonder if this waterfront will be around as my little grandson grows up. If we don't take bold action on climate change now, it's going to change the shape of our city for the worse. We don't have any time to waste. With Democrats in charge, the Senate is treating climate change like the crisis it is, and I'll fight for our future.
Now,
he doesn't have a primary opponent yet.
He does not have a primary opponent yet. When I hear fight and think biking and think Schumer, I remember how he and his family fought the building of bike lanes in Brooklyn. I think that was about 8 or 9 years ago.
Well, now I think of spandex because he put that image in all of our minds for some reason.
But if Chuck Schumer really wants to fight for climate change and meet the promise of the implication of Democrats controlling the Senate, Chuck Schumer has to do more than simply ride his bike around Brooklyn. He has to push for some form of repeal of the filibuster, whether that's a reformation of it in some fashion or another. And if he's not able to influence folks like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, one has to wonder, like, what is the value of having him in leadership? Maybe nobody can do it, but maybe somebody else should have a try.
Well, I mean, I agree entirely. He is not the kind of arm-twisting Senate majority leader that is necessary in these current times, because the clock is ticking specifically on climate change, and there needs to be bold action in that area by the Senate majority leader in order to get Manchin and Sinema, Kyrsten Sinema specifically, speaking out against the PRO Act the other day, which was leaked, I think, to the press. And those are two major priorities that need to be passed And
indeed,
with the filibuster being eliminated.
Yeah, and Chuck Schumer perceives himself as the concierge sometimes more than a leader of the Senate. But that's all our time for today. We will be back. Emma and I will be back tomorrow. We will see you then. Or we will see you now.
Yes.
In fact, Emma will see you now. I will see you now to say adieu. We're going to be heading into the fun half of the program, and joining us will be Brandon Sutton, and of course, old Matt, will be joining Emma in the fun half with new Matt and Brendan. Just a reminder: we launched our Discord channel, and we already, since I announced it almost exactly 24 hours ago, we've had over 1,200 people join.
Wow.
So you go to majoritydiscord.com and sign up. And sign up for the Discord, and you get to communicate with folks from all different platforms in the Majority Report universe, as it were. And if you want to become a member of the program, head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that makes this show possible. When you do, you get not only support the free show, you get it free of commercials, and you get access to the fun half. And then we're going to work out other features. I don't know if we're going to do anything with the Discord, but we're getting all our ducks in a row. And then, like with those new Republican anti-protest laws, we're just going to mow them down, and it'll be perfectly legal. With our motor vehicle. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off at 3 p.m. today. Check out the Nomiki Show on youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow and twitch.tv/Nomiki_show. And now coming in for the fun half, old Matt, what's happening on Doom these days?
How you doing, Sam? Well, first, actually, I have to ask you a favor. My dad tried to get through the show yesterday, Binder Dad, because it was his birthday and he wanted a shofar. There we go.
We have to finish. Binder Dad a shofar, drop of a hat.
Perfect, perfect. Now that that's out of the way and my dad's happy, tune in tonight, youtube.com/MattBinder, 9 p.m. Eastern time. We'll be looking at the right-wing freakout over the results of the case against Derek Chauvin. You know, right-wing has completely lost their mind over this, from Fox News to the right-wingers online. And we'll be looking at all of them, youtube.com/MattBinder, 9 p.m. Eastern time tonight.
Brandon Sutton of The Discourse will be joining everybody in the fun half. But meanwhile, what's going on in The Discourse?
Well, you know, besides SEO problems, as you could imagine, I actually recently got vaccinated, so I've been feeling very docile. So I have a bunch of lukewarm takes that we're going to be presenting the next episode. And we have one of the DC Sentinel Sams coming onto our Twitch channel to game and, you know, just basically talk trash. As the kids say, so you know.
Is it random? Is it sort of a guess which one it's going to be?
Well, I mean, I assume they only still have two of them. I mean, I haven't been keeping up with them. If they're multiplying, I guess we got to roll like a d20 or something to figure out which one. So, it's always a guess, I imagine.
And so the 5G is starting to kick in from that vaccine that you got.
I have never gotten better cell phone signal, Sam. Let me tell you. It's outside, inside, in the subway. In some sort of above ground train, if that's such a thing, you know, I get full bars, 4 or 5 bars, and unlimited data.
Wow, that's pretty good.
You're on the subway, and then that's how you know the microchip's working.
Yeah, the queue when you get down to Canal, you never got better signals ever since since getting that shot.
That is and a notoriously bad subway.
That's a bad
signal
that's
stop.
A bad yeah. Signal stop. Matt, old I'm new Matt. What's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, Nando Vila on tonight, 8 Eastern, YouTube, Left Reckoning, to talk about the collapse of the Super League. And we also have Charmaine Chua and one of the workers who was in Chicago at the Amazon Wildcat strike to talk about organizing in the flexible production era and sort of a follow-up from Bessemer and maybe alternative models to try to get some worker power against these behemoths. So check that out tonight, 8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning, but go subscribe to the YouTube page, Left Reckoning, folks.
All right. Well, the House has just passed the D.C. statehood bill. A little breaking news, H.R. 51. We will see what happens in the Senate. I will take leave. These guys will see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. See you then.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.